Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, now in depth on why the truth about Truvine is so hard to tell. There's a photograph in Beth Macy's new book of two brothers in dapper suits with bow ties, unsmiling as they look at the camera. The picture was taken in 1926, and a caption was written on it that said, "Are they ambassadors from Mars?" That's one of the many bizarre indignities the Muse brothers endured in decades in the circus. But there was always a mystery about how they ended up as big top sideshows. Beth had heard the tale of the brothers from Truvine, Virginia, for years, and her new book examines the exploitation, the inequities, and the love at the center of this story. Beth Macy's book is titled Truvine, and it is part of our Best Books series for 2016. And Beth joins me now from Virginia. And Beth, welcome back to the show. It's good to talk to you again.
Thanks, Carrie. It's great to be back.
I was reading about some of the things that you tell young journalism students, and I realized that this book project probably exemplifies all of them. You say be friendly, be skeptical, keep digging. I mean, if you hadn't done all of that, you probably wouldn't have this story about Truvine, would you?
Absolutely. I would not have, because the family, the first time I asked if I could tell the story of... I think I recount this in the book. I wander into the soul food restaurant that's being managed by the brother's caregiver and great niece, and she points to a sign on the wall that somebody's given her that says, "Sit down and shut up." And basically, she was not going to let anybody do the story because she had been sort of humiliated her whole life and about it, and they had been exploited and they were resting. And as she pointed out recently, you didn't know what you didn't know.
Ah, is that true?
That is true. I mean, I had no idea how the family story had been quashed, how I didn't know that her first memory as a kid was people banging on their doors and demanding to see the, quote, savages that eat raw meat. And I didn't understand kind of the minefield that I was walking into, and in that sort of clueless way that we have as young journalists, thinking it's all right to ask for a story without really understanding all the nuance and the history and just the subjugation and the way this family had been mistreated. I'm sure I came across as somebody who didn't yet deserve the right to tell this story.
You know, I think this be skeptical part of this is really important, because I can hear you, and I know you've told this story with a lot of compassion and empathy. You'd heard the legend, quote unquote, of the Muse brothers. You were eager to find out what was at the bottom of it, but you never dropped your, "But is this story really the way that everybody's telling it?" You never dropped that approach, which turned out to be so important, didn't it?
Yeah. About a quarter of the way through the research, I found some documentation that suggested that despite what the family had always been told, that the brothers had been kidnapped from a tobacco field while they were working as sharecropper or field hands around the turn of the last century. And along had come a bounty hunter that kidnapped them and put them in the circus. There was some documentation, flawed though it may also be, that perhaps their mother had initially let them go. It came in the form of a 1914 billboard notice that someone had taken out on her behalf. We don't really know who, saying that she had let them go. She was expecting them back. It was Christmas, and she missed them. So she didn't read. So we don't really know if she took that ad out herself or with the help of a friend, or whether a showman who was missing them because they were valuable acts took them out instead. So we don't really know the truth. And I think after going down so many rabbit holes in my research, I just had to pronounce it unknowable, which is frustrating.
But I mean, as you say, this story of, and I think it's a more dramatic story if these two young brothers half African-American albinos. They look unusual. They're, as you say, they're working in this tobacco field. They're young boys. And the dramatic version of this is that this bounty hunter hears about them, comes into the field, and basically kidnaps them away from the tobacco field and takes them off to the circus. And for a long time, that's the story that a lot of people in Truvine and the family told, isn't it? Why is it important that we know really how they, how maybe the family's involvement was different than the legend from the very beginning?
I think it's important just to give the reader all the information that I could come up with and let them make up their own mind. I think it's also important to say that the family is never going to believe that version of the events. And in fact, it insults them and offends them and makes them think that somebody who's spouting that is perhaps just one more person, one more journalist who's trying to quash their version of the story. But as I say, I had to be fair. Willie Muse himself said that he was kidnapped from a tobacco field. He named his kidnapper, which was his longtime manager. And I had to be really careful. I didn't want to be that one more journalist who was mocking him or not letting him have his voice in his own story.
There was a time, though, Beth, and you make this clear in the book, then that bounty hunters actually did do this. I mean, they found circus acts and they kidnapped people to go to the circus, didn't they?
That is true. There's several examples in the book. There are also examples of the reverse, where families who were poor and struggling, especially Black families late in the last century, struggling to feed all the mouths in their family. And so you have all variations in and just the lack of a documentation, it's just so hard to know.
It's really important, I think, to know the context that you give us about the Virginia that these boys were born into. Will you tell us a bit about what it was like then? And again, this is 1899, right, when they end up in the circus.
Yeah, well, we have documentation of them first working as sideshow exhibits in a carnival. The first actual documentation we have is 1914. Okay. And their birth dates were all over the place in the records. Some say they were born in the 1890s, others in the early 1900s. So it's hard to know. Again, recording of Black families' genealogy, it's just really hard to pin down because the record keeping was so bad and illiteracy added to that. But during that time in Truvine, Virginia, which is a little sharecropping tobacco community, it's still a tobacco community. There's not much there. It's an unincorporated crossroads and with a vibrant church, but that's basically about it. Everything that was a store and whatnot was closed. But conditions for sharecroppers were really rough. And I tried to paint that world by talking to people who had stayed in Truvine and who still had memories of this, many of them working in tobacco up until the 50s, 60s, just to show how that world might have been for Harriet Muse, how desperate she may have been to earn money to feed her family. And so I spent a lot of time examining how sharecroppers were taken advantage of, how they were often would work the whole season long. And at the end, when the farmer would sell the tobacco in Danville at the market, he would come back and say, oh, well, I didn't get the price I wanted. You're not going to get paid this year. Or he'd pay him a little bit and say, now you have to pay me back for the money I lent you for seed and fertilizer earlier in the year. And it was just as one guy put it, you're working one day for yourself and one day for the man, and some days, no days for yourself at all.
And if this sounds like ancient history, it isn't to the people that, I mean, these wounds, I think, as you discovered as you approach the family about the story, are still pretty raw.
Yes, and not just with the sharecropping, but also just conditions in the Jim Crow South in the cities. The family moves in the 19-teens to Roanoke, trying to get out of sharecropping. Everybody wanted to come and work for the railroad, so there was a lot of this internal migration going on within Virginia. And the best job in town at the time is to be a laborer on the railroad. Well, that doesn't happen for the family. Harriet Muse works as a domestic worker. And so one of the questions that presents itself pretty early on is, maybe were the brothers better off traveling with the circus, where at least, you know, they had three square meals a day and a place to lay their head? My job was really to paint a picture of what life was like for the family in Roanoke, Virginia, where they settled in the poorest neighborhood, crammed into a 500 square foot shack with no running water, and in a neighborhood where slumlords would accept sex and partial rent in some circumstances, where they were told what blocks they could live on, where one woman recalled walking by a house on the way to school, and a white woman had taught her parrots to squawk racial epithets at them on their way to school. And just these memories just lodged so deeply in people's psyche that I was really grateful to be able to get these stories from these older folks while we still can get them.
Beth Macy is with us. If you've tuned in, she's the author of True Vine, Two Brothers, A Kidnapping and a Mother's Quest, A True Story of the Jim Crow South. And it is one of our books in our Best Books series. Beth joining us this morning from Roanoke, Virginia. I think for listeners who have not had the benefit I've had, which is seeing these photographs that you've included in the book, it's important to describe, Beth, what it was that was so unusual about the way they looked and why it captured, and there's no denying this, it captured the imagination of circus goers and, to some degree, people who might never see them in person because they were written about in newspapers.
Yes. And photographs, because of their story was never recorded, photographs were some of the best evidence I had. So I spent a lot of time, you know, there's a lot of pictures of them already available online, but I spent a lot of time scouring museum archives to find new photographs of them. And I think one of the most moving moments of my research is when I found the very first picture of them as child sideshow exhibits. So it's around 1914, and they just look like scared young boys, you know. They're standing there in their two small suits. And I sent the photograph off to a historic costume expert who saw all these details in the picture that I hadn't seen. And just to paint the picture of how scared they must have been. They're wearing these suits for a year or longer, and they're too small. And just trying to suss out what must have been going on in their heads during that time from a photograph.
Tell me about some of the things that that expert told you that you didn't see at first glance.
Yeah, well, he blew up the pictures, that earliest picture I was talking about. He blew it up, and he noticed that the seams were kind of almost to the point of splitting. So he said, well, they've been wearing these suits for 1 or 2 years.
Wow.
At least. And, you know, he said they were pretty nice suits. He knew exactly, like, who had made the suits, and that the whole idea, you wouldn't mistreat an act that you were going to have exhibited in the sideshow. So it's like they were presented with the idea that they were being taken care of, but you could tell by the looks in their face, you could tell by the details in the costumes and how worn they were, that they really weren't being that well taken care of.
The photograph that I talked about in the introduction is, as you say, taken sometime between 1918 and 1922, and you say this is the only known photograph of the Muse brothers with one of their captors, showman Al G. Barnes, who bragged in his memoir about, quote, buying the boys and making them a paying proposition. Their expressions, I won't put that into words. I don't want to color what you're going to say about it, but as you look at that photograph, Beth, what could you draw about their willingness to be there, their state of mind, their happiness in looking at their faces in these pictures?
Yeah. One of the things I always do when I see a picture of Willie is I always look at his hands first, because
really?
He's clenching his hands in almost every picture. If you go back and notice that. The only picture he looks that he's not doing that is where he's holding an instrument, which is the source of much happiness for him, music in his life. But that picture, it just, in addition to being kind of a stunning picture, That is a time in the early 20s when they were still being told that their mother was dead, to quit crying. And as I say, this is the only known picture of them with one of their captors. And in 1936, he actually wrote his memoir where he brags about buying them. And that was just a given. I mean, again, to get their mindset back into the 1920s and 30s when most white people believed that African Americans were subhuman beings. It was okay what he had done with them, because who was going to question him about it? In fact, he's even going to brag about it in his memoirs. So that was just the real challenge, was to put the reader back in that mindset. And that's why I spent so much time describing the context, not only of sharecropping and not only of life in Roanoke and during the Jim Crow South, but also what life was like for them on the circus.
What do you, as noted, they are at times presented as ambassadors from Mars, or they come from a different planet, or they come from an unexplored land. I mean, you know, the people that that were gawking at them, and we should talk a little bit about this culture of gawking at freaks and why that seems to be a thread that continues up to this day. But I mean, what? Tell me how you think the people that were viewing them in these circus acts, what they looked like to them and what they thought about it. It's just so bizarre to come with a contemporary mindset to try to understand this. I guess that's what I'm asking about.
Yeah. Well, and also, I guess first we should go back just to a time between 1840 and 1914 when the circus was the most popular form of entertainment. Before TV, radio, films were popular as professional sports. When factory work was just getting started, when people had a little bit of cash money to spend, and they would often save it for the one time of year when the circus would come through their town. They said the circus was the number two day in importance of the year after Christmas, Circus Day. So the sideshow grew out of this, popularized by Barnum as early as the 1860s. The sideshow was this extra admission. It'd be a tent next to the big top. And the goal was to get people to pay an extra quarter to come in. And one of the ways they did that was, advertising. They have these banners of the acts inside, whether it be the fat lady or the family of dwarves or Eco and Ico, the ambassadors from Mars, the Texas giant. And it was a time before people thought about things like disability rights or child labor and exploitation, or of it was actually thought to be kind of a scientific, that was the kind of the educational spin they would put on it. This is a scientific pursuit to go and look at these differently abled people. And they called them freaks. And that was a big challenge for me. I found the pictures really hard to look at in the beginning. But like anything, I got sort of used to it after looking at hundreds of them. But still trying to peer back into history and say, if I was alive during that time, would I have wanted to see that? Oh, it's hard to imagine.
You're listening to my conversation with Beth Macy. The book is called True Vine, one of the best books of 2016. You can read about it on the thread. And more of the conversation after the latest news. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. Senate committees are holding more confirmation hearings today for cabinet positions under a President Donald Trump. GOP Congressman Tom Price for Health and Human Services Secretary, Wilbur Ross to be Commerce Secretary, Scott Pruitt to be EPA Administrator, and South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley to be U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. A top Republican senator says Congress should not finalize repeal of President Obama's health care law unless it first has a replacement ready. Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee says Obamacare is like an old bridge in danger of collapse, but first it needs repairs, then new bridges before the old one is closed. President Obama is expected to defend his decision to shorten the sentence of convicted leaker Chelsea Manning when he holds his final news conference today. Manning asked Obama last November to commute her 35-year-old sentence for giving classified government and military documents to the WikiLeaks website. Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan calls the Manning commutation outrageous. A Democratic congresswoman has made an unannounced trip to Syria. That word comes from a spokeswoman for Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii. She says Gabbard is on a fact-finding mission to Syria and Lebanon. Emergency crews have made dozens of high water rescues as thunderstorms flood streets in Texas. Flash flood warnings are in effect in Houston, where torrential rains prompted officials to close schools. The area's public transportation has also been delayed or suspended for today. Three strong earthquakes shook central Italy in the space of 1 hour today, striking the same region that suffered a series of deadly quakes last year. No major damage or injuries are reported. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:27.
Hi, it's Maria. Maria Hinojosa from Latino USA, the NPR program heard coast to coast each week. So let me ask you something. You have so much information at your fingertips that don't you sometimes feel overwhelmed by it all? Here at Latino USA, we know that your time is valuable, which is why our team prides itself on producing original stories that you won't hear anywhere else. Check us out, give us a listen, and share us with your friends and family. Thanks for listening.
I'm Tom Weber. Next hour on NPR News, we'll discuss ways to strengthen economies in greater Minnesota, and you'll hear an update on the Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya. What of plans to close it? We discuss at 11.
Programming is supported by The Guthrie. Coming soon, The Royal Family. Set in 1920s Manhattan, this classic American comedy shines a spotlight on the most famous family on Broadway. Performances begin January 28th. Tickets at GuthrieTheater.org.
Beth Macy is with us if you tuned in, and we're talking about her book that ended up on a number of best books of 2016 lists. It's called True Vine, Two Brothers, a Kidnapping and a Mother's Quest, a true story of the Jim Crow South. You can see what we wrote about it on the thread at nprnews.org/thread. Beth, I asked if you would just read a few paragraphs about which really go to how they were seen in these circus sideshows. Would you be good with that?
Yeah, happy to do that.
Great, thank you.
As albinos, they were among the rarer finds, somewhere between a giant and a limbless man in the freak show pecking order. Inside the tent, lecturers introduced George and Willie to ticket holders, or rubes, as the showmen referred, dismissively to customers behind their backs, via hyperbolic spiel or lecture, which began like this. The brothers were descended from monkeys in the dark continent, with Neanderthal heads, cavemen bodies, and tremendous shocks of hair that stand out on their heads like the wigs on Raggedy Ann dolls. Two Ecuador white savages, they are pure albinos with skins as white as cream and with all of the facial characteristics of South African bushmen. All for this significant sum of one dime, two nickels, 10 coppers, 1/10 of a dollar, the price of a shave or a hair ribbon, you can witness the greatest, most outstanding aggregation of marvels and monstrosities gathered together in one edifice, looted from the ends of the earth. Sparing no expense, every town, every village, every hamlet, every nook and cranny of the globe has been searched with a fine-tooth comb to provide this feast for the eye and mind. Step right up, ladies and gentlemen, and avoid the rush. So that was how the spieler might have introduced them. And then I write, they were cast, in other words, as anything but what they actually were, a pair of black boys from Virginia with calloused hands and alabaster skin, boys who cried themselves to sleep at night.
Beth Macy reading from her book, True Vine. In the fall of 1927, now how long at that point, Beth, have they been with circuses, and not the same circus, right? By the fall of 27,
right. They start out with smaller carnivals and kind of work their way up. They get sold from one entity to another. So we know they've been without their family for at least 13 years by 1927.
And again, they have been told for many years that their mother is dead.
Exactly,
and
told
why?
To quit crying, your mother is dead. I'm sure they just wanted to mollify them. They said early on that it was really, really rough. And in some of those early years, you know, during World War One, George, who was just older by 3 years, sort of became like the father figure to Willie. And, you know, they would talk about their mother and they would wonder if she was still alive. And George would always reassure her that I know she's still alive. In my bones, I can feel it. And when they would see a rainbow in the sky, they would point it out to each other and remind them what their mother always said, that that was God's promise after the storm. And so George would use that to try to cheer Willie up.
Do you know if at this point, before we talk about how their mother learns that where they are, do you know if they were being paid at this point? Because I that will come later, but is that true
they
now?
No, they were not being paid at this point. According to the lawsuit that comes up later, they weren't. There was no remuneration to the family for a period of at least 13 years.
Not to them or to the family?
Exactly.
Okay.
I mean, they were just supposed to be happy for the opportunity to have their room and board and be kept up.
So it's the fall of 1927, and somehow their mother learns that her sons are going to be in a circus that's coming to Roanoke. And at this point, as you say, it's been 13 years since she's seen them. This is a really dramatic decision about what she's going to do. Why is there so much risk involved in how she's going to what she's going to do when she learns this?
Yeah, well, that was part of the fun of like digging into the research of this. Is I always had heard from the family that she got them back in 1927. In 2001, I had done a newspaper article on this, and we had found the original clippings. It was on the front page of the Roanoke Times for 5 days in a row. It was a big brouhaha when she got them back. The police didn't want to let them go with her. The Ringling lawyers didn't want to let them go with her. And it becomes so much more interesting when I really delved into that period and learned that the fairgrounds where they were performing had been the site of a KKK rally just a few months earlier. And the top law enforcement official in the city, who was the Commonwealth's attorney, had been the founder of that very KKK, which was the largest Klan in the state. So when you layer that over top of all of her almost suicidally bold maneuvers that she had to do that day, it makes it even more impressive, I think, and more kind of stunning.
I mean, she's a woman without a lot of resources. She's an African-American woman who doesn't have a lot of power, obviously, in the community and not much money. And she does know what she's going up against, right, to try to reclaim her sons.
Yes. And, you know, the family always said it had come to her in a dream that her boys were with the circus. Go to the circus, her granddaughter Dot told me in 2001. That was Nancy's mother. And nobody really knows exactly how she found out that they were there that day. But it was interesting to talk to circus historians and historians of segregation who pointed out that really she shouldn't have been there that day. There was a place reserved for blacks, typically in the back. They called it the back end blues at the back part of the Big Top, where African-Americans would go to watch the rest of the circus. But the sideshow was the one place where segregation often broke down because patrons stood up and they walked from one act to the next as the spieler introduced each act. Sort of the patrons would sort of move around the platform and hear each person either give a demonstration of their skill, or in George and Willie's case, they would play music. And so you can imagine her sort of making her way up to the front, because we have to remember that because of their albinism, they were legally blind from birth and didn't see very well. But somehow, I mean, this is a scene that Willie would recount for his remaining days, just how astonished he was to look up after his brother elbows him and says, "Look, there is our dear old mother. She is not dead." And it's just an amazing scene, and even richer when you know how much she was up against.
I mean, it gives
opinion.
Me chills just to hear you relate it the way you did. The other thing is that she's seeing them in the company of all these other people who are viewing them as freaks. You know, I don't think we should miss the impact of that either, should we?
Yeah, right. No, I don't think so. That's a really good point. I'm sure she was probably the only Black person in the tent as well.
Right.
And then to have 8 policemen come up and challenge her when the manager wanted to take them home, that was something Willie would exclaim upon for the whole rest of his life. Even when he was totally blind at the end of his life, he kept a picture next to his bed of his mother. He couldn't even see it, but he would straighten it every night before he went to bed, and he would tell Nancy, his caregiver, she could have died. She could have been jailed. She came for us, our mother, our dear old mother, she came for us. And, you know, you can say what you want, that we don't exactly know what her motivations were. We don't exactly know the genesis of how they got with the first carnival. But we know what she did that day because it's been well documented and recorded. And it was something he would never forget.
I don't want people to think that even if it is murky about the way they ended up in the circus, that obscures, you know, whether they went willingly, whether the family was okay with that for a short time, whether they were kidnapped, whatever. That doesn't obscure, A, the way they were treated in the circus, but that they vanished. I mean, their mother had no idea what had happened to her sons for more than a decade. I mean, we have to emphasize that.
Absolutely. And then to take such a risk to get them back. And not only that, that was a Friday when she got them back. That Monday, she goes downtown, finds a very ambitious young white lawyer, and files a lawsuit against the greatest show on earth.
That's really amazing.
That's pretty astonishing. We're talking about an illiterate maid in Jim Crow, Virginia. And then she continually just astonished me throughout the research of this book.
How so?
So she wins a settlement. We don't know exactly how much, but I go into some detail about what the money did, bad and good, for the family. But later in the 30s, they're back with the circus again. The family said it was by choice. They decided to go back. It was partly, I'm sure, it was the only life they really knew, and it was a way to make money for their family and for themselves. But they were supposed to be getting paid. And their manager, who did this several times throughout their career until he was finally separated from them, once Ringley would start paying them, he would just move them to another show and then continue pocketing their wages again. Jeez. Thinking that, what's Harriet Muse, an illiterate maid back in Roanoke, Virginia? How's she even going to track me down? Well, she tracked him down. She found another lawyer, filed another lawsuit that resulted in every time the money not coming home, the lawyer would send out missing persons detectives, Pinkerton detectives. They would track them down, and she would make them pay.
I mean, it's amazing.
So she's subverting the system at every turn, and it's not easy for her.
So my question is, all the legal wrangling and the stuff that Harriet Muse does ends up changing the terms by which George and Willie are going to work for the circus. And you say at one point that now they are, quote, in on the joke. Do you mean of the sideshow? What does that mean?
Well, that's something you'll hear from a lot of sideshow historians and people who still kind of revere the sideshow and its history. And this was, and it's also something George and Willie said a lot. They would say, the patrons who come were laughing at us, but backstage we were laughing at them because they were paying to see us. And once they were getting paid in the 30s and going forward until their retirement, they enjoyed it. You can see in the literature, in the news clippings, they're happier in the photographs. Other circus performers talked about how they would, it was called the circus backyard. That was kind of the backstage part of the circus. How the brothers would entertain and play music as they were packing up to get ready to go to the next stop. And, you know, they were accepted. They were, and they were proud of what they did. And so were people back home. Like, I remember one elderly African-American woman saying, they were the first Black folks we ever knew to ride on an airplane. You know, they swam with the dolphins in Hawaii. They traveled all over. And they went from being like in their own community back home, sort of this cautionary tale, to at the end of their life, sort of wise elders with these great stories. And so it was just kind of a remarkable transition for them.
Beth, did you have to kind of wrestle with the realization that their lives in the circus, for all of the difficulty and the inequity, probably ended up being better than their lives would have been if, you know, they'd ended up sharecropping or picking tobacco? Or, I mean, how did you, tell me how you kind of reconciled that?
Yeah, I just tried to show it. So I tried to go out and find people that I interviewed who did pick tobacco most of their lives and who didn't get out of this system. I mean, the brothers, they actually said they traveled as white people. They didn't have to go to the black bathrooms and whatnot. You know, of course, we have to remember they were never able to go to school, and that was a regret they had their whole life. They never learned how to read. Late in his life, even though he was totally blind, Nancy taught him how to write his name, his own name, so he wouldn't have to sign with an X, even though he couldn't see what he was writing. And yeah, it's just, it's so interesting that at the end of his life, when he is being cared for by home health aides and doctors and nurses, he becomes kind of this person who gives people advice and who could tell by the tone of their voice what kind of day they're having, and is always coaching Nancy, who grew up sort of an angry person because of all that had happened to her as a kid and being made fun of about the brothers. Would tell her things like, you know, when you go around angry, Nancy, you miss the blessings that the Lord has in store for you.
Wow.
So even at the end, he was teaching and he was able to embody this great spirit of grace and forgiveness, really.
So I was looking at some photographs of your writing office online, Beth. And it's the
you
office.
You should see it now. It's even worse.
Is it? Okay. It's the office where you wrote Factory Man, and I assume where you wrote True Vine. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Okay. My little home spare bedroom turned into an office.
Is that what it is? Okay. So, you call it a holy mess. And I thought this was interesting. You have timelines from, I think, your first book, Factory Man, and an actual brick from the factory that you were writing about. And you call this trust building and context layering. And it sounds to me like you put to work what you learned writing Factory Man to True Vine.
Oh, yeah.
Is that right? Yeah. Okay.
I really did. I mean, so the interesting thing is they're very different stories, but they actually cover the same period of time.
Oh.
And really, True Vine and Bassett, Virginia are about 30 miles away from
really?
Each other as the crow flies. Huh. I mean, and if you remember from Factory Man, I cover some of the same issues about the way the domestic helpers
Definitely.
Were treated. And so there are themes of race and greed and exploitation running throughout both books. But wrestling 120 years of history, I just trying to keep it all on the same timeline with what was going on in the country in both books, what was going on in the world. It helped me to sort of map it all out. I have this whiteboard that I have on my wall. It's called Wizard Wall. And so I have it like one whole wall I can write on and erase with a whiteboard marker.
Wait a minute. Wizard Wall is a product name, or you call it
Wizard
the Wizard
Wall?
Wizard
Wall is a product name.
Oh, it
name.
Is. Okay.
Yeah, and I'm their number one like spokesman. No, they should give me, they should at least send me a free roll. No, I'm kidding. But the great thing about it is like you can take it down, and like if I go to a writing colony or something, you can just wrap it up and take it down.
Jeez.
And stick it up.
I need one of those. I'm getting one of those.
It's a great product.
So, Beth, all this to ask you what's happening with Factory Man, because wow, what a well-told story, and I've heard it's in television production. Is that right?
Yeah, it's in development, they call it, which means like they've hired writers to work up a script. I haven't seen the script yet. It's a little slower process than perhaps I would like. But it's pretty exciting. And, you know, these issues of trade and the economy continue to be very relevant today.
Boy, absolutely.
So I'm hoping that will eventually come to the screen.
Yeah. Tom Hanks is attached to it somehow. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. His company Playtone optioned it.
And is he going to star in it? Do you know?
I don't know for sure. I'm hopeful.
Beth, wow. This has been a real pleasure. I wish you the best of luck with Factory Man. Has this been, by any chance, optioned already for film or Truvine?
Truvine has, it's been reported, nothing firm yet, but it's actually been reported that it's a negotiation for a film. So I can't really say too much more, but I'm hopeful. I mean, any story I think today that helps people understand what African Americans in this country went through, I think it is I think we need to know this history. Somebody said, you know, history isn't facts and figures. It's a pain in the heart. And we're going to repeat history until we're able to make another person's pain our own. And I think through stories, this is one way we can do this. And I just I love that, you know, maybe someday coming to a screen near you, you'll get to see Harriet Muse and all that she went through during her moments of her trials and tribulations, just sort of prevailing and getting justice for her family. I think she's a great unknown hero, and I would love for more people to know her story.
Beth Macy's book is called Truvine, and you can read about it on the thread, nprnews.org/thread. And Beth, thank you.
Thank you, Carrie.
Weren't you there when the carousel burnt down? The fire and confusion, the smoke and the sound. I swear.